This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call our show Main Street because what better place to gather this time of day than around your radio, driving in the car, meeting somebody on a real Main Street, maybe with your iPod, whatever, your iPhone, your ears filled with the music that you love that day, and you say hi to somebody, and you greet them, and maybe you commiserate about just being a few hours away from a very important holiday called Valentine's Day. But we're going to talk about the gifting end of Valentine's Day with horticulturist Ron Smith. I've got Ashley Thornburg in studio with us as well. And, of course, flowers are a typical gift to give around Valentine's Day, but there are other horticulturally connected gifts like wine from grapes and chocolate from cacao beans. we're really, you know, stretching this horticulture idea a bit today.
Sure. Well, horticulture ties everything together. You know, that's the nice thing about it.
Mother Nature's very generous like that.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, I just sent a Valentine's gift to my daughter and my granddaughter. And I knew they would like it. It was a big bouquet of mixed flowers and a box of chocolates. And, of course, they got it. And, of course, the two of them wiped out the box of chocolates right away, which I knew that was going to happen. But then they have the flowers to admire and appreciate. So when you are considering flowers, if it's to your family, try to order something that's going to last a good long time. You don't have to get a romantic flower bouquet. I mean, you don't want to send a dozen red roses to your sister. You know, I would never do that. I'd probably send a black rose to my sister just to irritate her. Okay.
She knows you too well.
And yeah, right. And so
I'd send you the corpse flower.
Oh, thank you.
Get it bloom every 25 years or whatever.
Yeah. And you have to leave the house when it does
bloom. Yeah, when it does bloom, it would, yeah, ooh, that would be pretty bad. But anyway, there's ways that you identify your gifts. Now, if you have a single love, a person that you are married to and you're happy to be with, and there's nobody else in the wings either side, there better not be, if you want to live long, that's the person that you'd want to give a single red rose to, a nice deep red rose, no thorns on it. They can dethorn the rose if they don't have thornless roses. And then you have a box of high-quality chocolates like Swiss chocolates. And you accompany that with a good bottle of wine. And then that's also to go out to dinner that night. And you go to a very, very nice fancy place. It's not McDonald's or any other fast food place. That's not appropriate for Valentine's Day. You want to go out to a very high-class place. And don't worry about your budget. You can survive it. And that kind of erases the sting of, you know, past Christmas bills that are sitting there waiting to be paid, and you're paying off your credit card minimum amount each month, or you have taxes coming up that you owe and you're kind of depressed about that. So this Valentine's Day is a good time to go ahead and really let loose of those negative feelings and burst with positive feelings of love, romance, friendship, companionship, whatever you want to go ahead and call it.
We have to lower the lights in here, I think.
Yeah.
Let's get back to that rose.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking for a really splendid rose.
Mm-hmm.
What am I looking for?
You want to look for a rose that's got lips on it. In other words, the rose bud itself, the flower, well, it can be completely tight. You know, and if you go to kiss somebody, they go back like that.
Well, I wish you could have seen that.
Yeah, that's
a nice tight lip face.
But if they do it like, what's the cartoon character I'm trying to think of? Is it Daffy Duck or somebody that has, I want to kiss you and they go, ooh. You know,
a big pucker.
Yeah, that's the way the rose flower should look, just in that puckering stage, like I'm ready to kiss you. That way it'll last a good long time. But one of the big disadvantages with roses is that they don't last that long. You can get them to last maybe a week to 10 days with proper care. But that's a stroke of luck if it happens that way. So but that's the one you want to look for. It'll last a good long time. If you want to put it out, when you're there in the room, the kitchen, the living room, wherever you're going to show it, put it out there during the day, then put it somewhere where it's cooler at night, maybe down in the basement, maybe out in your garage, maybe in your refrigerator for the night, you know, if you have enough room.
So that's quite cool.
Yeah, that is. Well, that'll hold it. What do you think they do in the florist shop? They have it pretty cool.
And what I like about this is that with that one single rose, that bottle of wine, you've probably saved enough money on roses to get that really good meal.
Oh, yes. Yes. They make money. And I'm not picking on them because this is really a depressing time of the year from the florist standpoint because you've gone past Christmas, the big expenditure. And now you're into this kind of a monetary drought. And so you come to this thing called Valentine's Day, and guys feel guilty for not paying attention to their girlfriends, their fiancés, or their wives, okay? And so they need to make up for it with this display of affection and sincerity and everything else. And if they don't do it, they're in real trouble.
Sweet-smelling mea culpa.
Yeah. If there was another planet to move to, I would suggest that they do so because there's nothing worse than the scorn of a woman and it's not happy.
Uh-oh.
Oh, I can see that. I'm glad your eyes don't project daggers, Ashley, because I'd be dead by now.
So who gets a dozen roses?
The dozen roses are to somebody that you've had your eye on and she's kind of responded a little bit to you. And you want to make sure that she remembers you, unless you're one of a dozen guys that give her a dozen roses. But I don't think that's going to happen. At least you hope not. And you've gotten your foot in the door enough that she's going to be thinking about you. So you send this big, beautiful bouquet of a dozen roses. That will get her interested. Okay, this guy's really interested in me. You want to go a little bit further. If she's indicated that there is some genuine affection there, that there might be a possibility of a lifetime of association with each other, romantic association with each other, raising a family with each other, paying bills with each other, whatever it might be, you throw in a box of chocolates. And if you have proposed to her and she's scratching her chin, she's thinking about it, she says, I'll let you know in a couple days. Throw in a bottle of good wine.
That couple of days is not a good sign.
No. Well, you know, so, she might want to see how persistent you are. You know, a good woman is you know, kind of keeps a guy at arm's length because she wants to make sure that he really, really wants to be in her company. Not just a passing.
So what I'm hearing is when you're interested, a dozen roses, the chocolate and the wine, and then when you're married, one rose. So you just get stingier over time? What is this?
It's just like a woman to interpret it that way. All right, what do you want? 6 dozen roses when you're married? Probably not. No.
That sounds
good, huh?
Well, are there any other flowers besides roses that are appropriate on Valentine's Day?
Oh, my gosh, yes. The whole slew of them. There's lilies, there's tulips, there's, you know, whatever the florist has. And
precursors of spring.
As spring, yes. Yeah. If you have a friend, a female friend, and, you know, if you want to send them some flowers, just send them a bouquet of mixed flowers. Mm-hmm. You know, as I appreciate your friendship, I appreciate the fact that we've worked together all these years, and you are wonderful to get along with. I hope we can keep it up. Bingo, here's a dozen flowers.
Well, if in this household these cut flowers only appear once a year, you know, on Valentine's Day, what's the best way to care for roses in a vase or something like
okay,
that?
Okay, well,
starting with leaving the florist with them, because
yes,
you want to put that in a nice bag, right, to protect the rose?
Well, yes, or you could have them delivered.
Okay.
And there are some organizations or some individuals out there, and I figured when I was pretending to be Santa Claus years ago when my kids were young and I had a lot more energy, I went around and played St. Nick, visiting people's houses. You can have St. Valentine's Day coming around, the Valentine's character coming around in a tuxedo and a high hat and recite poetry and give the flowers out. And so, you know, that's another way to go ahead and do something like that. That would really make a big impression. Wow, he really went all out to get my attention. I'm really, really impressed.
Okay, but I've got those cut flowers in a
vase
now.
Oh, okay, sorry. Okay, I didn't mean to avoid your questions there. Okay, when you're leaving the florist, if it's 20 below zero or anything close to zero, you want to make sure they're double wrapped, and a good florist will do that for you. You get them out, you bring them home. If you don't have them in a vase already, get them in a vase. Make fresh cuts at the bottom of the stems and put them in fresh water, and usually the florist will give you a little pill or a little powder that go ahead and put in there. They're called floral extenders or floral life. It'll help to extend it.
What is that stuff?
I really don't know offhand. I can't remember if I did. I did know at one time, but they change it all the time.
Is it true that aspirin is a decent substitute?
Yeah. What you want to do is try to kill any mold that would get started in
there.
Okay, because you have
So it's not food so much as a protecting?
Oh, yeah, it's a protectant. It keeps the water acid enough so that you're not going to be getting that mold getting started in there. So that's a good thing. The other thing to do if you want to have this bouquet last a long time, which most people do, you put it out on the kitchen table or the dining room table or the living room table where you're going to be seeing it every day. Okay, then at night, as the last thing you do as you're locking up the doors and things like that, put it out in the garage or put it in the refrigerator or put it in the coolest room in your house, the basement, someplace like that. And that way it'll last a lot longer. Of course, remember to bring it out the following morning and so you can continue to enjoy it.
Any pet concerns with some of the flowers and plants that might be coming in?
Any what?
Pet concerns, a cat, a dog, iguanas, I don't know, whatever you have at home.
Iguanas? Okay.
People like other things.
All right. Anyway, yes, cats especially. Cats are very, very curious. A dog might look at it, sniff it, and nothing interesting. At least that's my experience with dogs. Cats might look at that and say, that could be something I would be competing with. It might take my affection, and dilute it, the affection from my master or mistress away, and I could lose it somewhat. So the cat might go over there and tip that over. Okay. They might go over there and nibble on some of the flowers. That type of thing. With dogs, it's totally immaterial to them as far as I know.
Okay. So. Well, we've got our flowers.
Mm-hmm.
Let's break out a bottle of wine.
Yes. Okay. So wine. Red wine has to be the one to consider unless your love is absolutely made it clear that she does not like any red wine. She hasn't found a red wine that she likes. Then forget it. Don't buy her a red wine. You can buy her some non-vintage champagne. Okay. Hey, that's pretty good stuff. Non-vintage champagne is good and it's affordable.
It's readily available.
Yeah, readily available. Yeah. So it's not something that you have to go out fishing for. Whatever you do, if you say, I'm going to get her a vintage champagne, you better have a pretty generous checking account to cover that, okay? Because vintage champagne is very, very expensive. It's triple, quadruple, whatever they can get for it on those vintage years. So better off buying a nice non-vintage champagne, and there's lots of varieties out there. She will be delighted. If champagne is still too expensive, there's other fizzy wines that you can get. Prosecco is the Italian's answer to champagne, and it goes over very well. I had a wine tasting last night where we served Prosecco, and it was a big hit for the people. So
what are you pouring for Betsy?
What am I pouring for Betsy? She will be very happy with the seven deadly sins of Zinfandel, old vine Zinfandel. And she likes that. I've tried her on it, and she says, that's a really good wine. I could go back for that again. So we'll have that again tomorrow night at dinner. And it's really old vine Zinfandel. Now, somebody ask me, please, what's the difference between old vine Zinfandel and young vine Zinfandel? Well, first of all, they aren't going to say young vine Zinfandel. They're just going to say Zinfandel. Zinfandel generally is high in alcohol, up there 14.5% to 15%. Old vine Zinfandel, every old vine Zinfandel bottle that I've come across is at 15%. That's the maximum that wine can reach as far as alcohol level goes. So it has a pretty heavy hit to it. The nice thing, I'm not saying your intentions are less than honorable, but, you're going to be having dinner with this, okay?
Yes.
And so it's going to be a nice, cool, happy, comfortable evening. So you enjoy this and then have a bit of chocolate afterwards. You don't have to eat a whole box of chocolates. Candy
False.
Kiss? Huh? What?
False. You do have to eat a whole box of chocolates.
Okay, I got corrected.
But chocolates and red wine.
Yeah, chocolates and red wine go together, especially this Zinfandel, because it has a nice lingering taste to it. It has character. If you say, what's wine with a character? Okay, drink Merlot. Take a drink of Merlot, or any other red wine, a red wine blend or mixture, and it's good wine. But you get into that Zinfandel, that old vine Zinfandel, and it has character. It definitely does. It hits your mouth right at the beginning, and it has a nice lingering, ah, that was good. I'm going to go back and take another sip.
So what does a bottle of that go for?
Well, you can find it all over the place. The wine tasting that I hosted last night was we were on a budget. So we bought these bottles of wine for under $15. So that's not bad. You can spend a heck of a lot more on it because it depends on what the vintner's trying to do. If he's trying to be very selective with his grapes, you know, only the very best grapes get handpicked and put into this particular concoction of wine, they'll be happy with it. Or are they really using old vine Zinfandel? The other thing to keep in mind, to call it a Zinfandel in every state except one, you have to have 75% of that varietal in that bottle. In other words, if you buy wine from California or Texas, and they're calling it Zinfandel, only 75% of that wine has to be of that varietal, except for the state of Oregon. They have passed a law that if you're going to call it Zinfandel, old vine or otherwise, or Cabernet Sauvignon or Merlot, it has to have at least 90% of that vine varietal in that bottle. Most of them go all the way and have 100%, and they'll put it on there, 100% of that particular varietal. So you're getting the real McCoy as far as that vine goes.
What do you look for when you are shopping for wine? How much does that label matter? Do you look for awards?
You know, that's like asking a man what he looks for when he's looking for beautiful women. What strikes you? Is it a woman's eye? And I'm not saying this to flatter you or flirt with you, but, you know, is it a woman's eyes? Is it her hair? Is it her poise? You know, what is it that catches your eye about a particular woman? With my wife, it was her beautiful red hair. I mean, and her height. She was tall, you know, and just striking, a very striking-looking woman. Bingo, that got my attention. And it's the same thing with a wine. If they have an attractive label, bingo, that's pretty doggone good. And I'll read the label and think, yeah, if it's not that expensive, we'll give it a try, you know. Or if I'm at a wine tasting and somebody says, this is a special wine, we spent $65 to have this wine being tasted here. Well, good, because I'll never spend $65 for a bottle of wine for myself. So I'll taste it and say, eh, it isn't worth $65. Or it might be worth $65 under some special occasion.
That chocolate, though, there is dark chocolate, there is milk chocolate.
And there's white chocolate.
Oh, yeah, which is not necessarily real chocolate.
What do you use?
Yeah.
Well, of course, you should know by this time what your true love likes. And, of course, if you're a couple of health nuts, you're going to say, I got you some dark chocolate, sweetheart. Good. That's better for me than plain milk chocolate. Okay, so you've made her very happy. If you've gotten her milk chocolate, it would indicate that you hadn't paid any attention to her preferences. And I haven't known a woman yet that doesn't state her preferences about anything, what you're wearing. I'm getting agreement from Ashley.
I'm just saying sometimes you have to say it 12 times.
Men are somewhat like that too, though.
But anyway, the chocolate should be something that's a given, for suitable for the partner that you're trying to please.
So you're running out of time to state your preference in flowers, chocolate, and wine, ladies out there, and gentlemen as well. So, Ron Smith, always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Coming up next, a University of Minnesota researcher talks about teens and gender identity.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Giving to Prairie Public is as simple as sending a text. Just text the word SUPPORT to 484848 and set up the monthly deduction of your choice. $5, $10, $15, $20 a month? It's as simple as that. Here's the deal. You give what you can, and Prairie Public delivers reliable, fact-based journalism and outstanding top-shelf programs without commercial interruption or influence. Simple. So reach for your smartphone and text the word SUPPORT to 484848 and simply support Prairie Public today. And thanks.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. A University of Minnesota researcher says more teens in the U.S. are identifying as transgender or gender nonconforming. In 2016, a survey went out to more than 80,000 teenagers in Minnesota. It included the question, do you consider yourself transgender, genderqueer, genderfluid, or unsure about your gender identity? Almost 3% of teens answered yes.
way more than previous research estimates. The findings were published in the journal Pediatrics. It reveals more teens in the United States are seeing gender as more than just masculine or feminine. Nick Ryder is a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Minnesota and the lead author of the study. She recently visited with NPR's Lulu Garcia-Navarro, host of Weekend Edition Sunday.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Why do you think more teens are identifying as transgender or gender nonconforming?
Well, I think there's been a long history of advocacy and fighting for that visibility, and there's more media attention and celebrities coming out that has increased visibility, and with more schools having more GSAs and clubs, it gives youth the chance to feel like they can talk about their gender exploration and live more like their authentic self.
To what extent do you see the study as a reflection of teens feeling more comfortable in diverse gender identities versus teens sort of experimenting with their identities and how they describe themselves?
It can be a combination of two, because I think that as people are experimenting with identities, they do identify with different identities at different times to try to understand if that's something that fits for them. I also think that as people are coming into different identities, like that feels very authentic for them and it feels very real.
So this study shows that more people self-identify in these ways. Does it speak to how other segments of the teenage population view genderqueer, gender fluid, transgender teenagers?
Well, one of the items they were asked is how they think that their peers are perceiving their gender expression, which means the way that they walk and talk in their style. How is that read in terms of gender? And what we're seeing is when people deviate from what society would expect, particularly in gender, then they experience higher rates of emotional distress and substance use, suicidal ideation, subsequent to bullying and other stigmatization.
One of the things that is mentioned in this is that school nurses will have a bigger role to play in this subject. Can you explain how?
Yeah, a lot of trans and gender nonconforming youth, you can see in the study, they report higher nurse office visits, and that may mean that they're actually going and talking to nurses. It can also mean that they are accessing bathrooms in the nurse's office. But either way, that means that nurses are interacting with youth more often. And so they may be a really important person to start having some important conversations about gender and what that means maybe on a day-to-day basis for these youth, or also providing health care for them in the school system.
Are teenagers understanding gender differently? Are they seeing that there's just more of a range of what it means to be masculine or what it means to be feminine or what it means to be something else altogether?
Yeah, I do think that youth are more open to understanding the expansiveness of what gender can and does entail. And I think they also have more access to information with the internet and with each other and with more organizations and clubs within schools. They have more opportunities to discuss these topics that maybe didn't exist in the past.
Why did you want to study this, may I ask?
One is a personal reason. I also identify as gender nonconforming and have my own personal experiences growing up around this and what this means for me. And a second reason is that we just don't have enough data to help make policy changes and advocate for supporting trans and gender nonconforming adults and youth.
That's Nick Ryder, postdoctoral fellow at the University of Minnesota. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Weekend Edition Sunday host Lulu Garcia-Navarro talked with Nick Ryder, postdoctoral fellow at the University of Minnesota, whose research shows more teens in the U.S. are identifying as transgender or gender nonconforming. Coming up on Main Street, are kids vulnerable to addictive technology? We'll have an interview about that, but first the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A Minnesota man who was turned away at a voting booth in 2010 is part of a case headed to the U.S. Supreme Court at the end of this month. The case, Minnesota Voters Alliance versus Mansky, challenges Minnesota's law on what clothes can be worn to the polls.
The thing I want from this lawsuit is the same thing I wanted on Election Day in 2010, and that is simply to wear what I want when I vote and to vote peacefully.
Andy Selig says he was wearing a T-shirt with an image of a Gadsden flag and slogan that read, quote, "Don't tread on me." He says an election official told him he needed to change his shirt, prevented him from voting for 5 hours, and took his name down for possible criminal prosecution. Selig says as the law stands, it violates not only his First Amendment rights, but the rights of every other American. He also says the law is confusing and is open for interpretation.
Here is the real problem. When I say I might be hassled, one election judge might not see any problem with a certain shirt, but a different election judge might. I see this as subtle voter suppression. Some people who may be ambivalent about voting anyway could very well decide they don't want their clothes to be analyzed and assessed for election judge correctness. When it becomes known that the state is allowed to threaten one person over his or her perfectly legitimate social expression, others may hear the message, you better watch what you say.
Dave Bremer is a senior attorney for Pacific Legal Foundation, the firm bringing the case. He says the statute bans all apparel with any political messaging.
Wearing that material with those kind of sayings just isn't incompatible with the purpose of a polling place. There's no evidence that any polling place have ever been disrupted by this material or caused a fight or anything of that. It's purely a suppressive measure that inhibits free political association and expression, which is the entire purpose of the First Amendment. And that is going to be the essence of our case before the Supreme Court and our argument before the Supreme Court in a couple weeks.
Bremer says the Supreme Court must affirm that laws banning peaceful, passive display of political speech are protected by the First Amendment. And tax season is usually a busy time for scammers, and this year is no exception. Captain Tori Jacobson of the Moorhead Police Department says many calls have come in over the last couple of weeks to report scams and fraud. He says many people report tax scams, but they aren't the only ones going around. He says romance scams, grandparent scams, and even scams about past due bills are being circulated.
We all know that scams happen year-round, but they take many different variations. We have people that often are either providing personal information so that their accounts can be verified on a telephone, or we've also had a number of people that have been misled that they have outstanding bills and balances that can be paid immediately through the purchase of various cards that they can get the number, transfer the number, and the money's gone.
Jacobson says he knows everyone is busy, but taking a moment to slow down and pay attention can help guard yourself from falling victim to one of these scams. He says they can be very manipulative and sophisticated.
We want to be mindful and ensure that if we have a financial responsibility that's outstanding, you know, we all want to try to make that right. But when someone solicits the contact with you by email or a telephone call, that in itself should raise questions as far as the validity. So we're asking that people take information as far as who's supposed to be contacted or paid and then ultimately follow up themselves.
Jacobson says if you feel you have been targeted by a scammer, you should report it to authorities. But he says oftentimes these cases are very difficult to resolve. He says scammers can target you from different communities, states, or even countries, and once money is transferred, it can be impossible to get back. He says if anyone asks you to pay them via gift card, it's probably not legitimate. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and we're joined by phone by Colby Zentel. She joins us from San Francisco. She is the Vice President for External Affairs for a nonprofit called Common Sense Media. Thanks for joining us, Colby.
Hi, Doug. Hi, Ashley. Thanks for having me.
Colby, what is Common Sense Media?
So Common Sense Media is a national nonprofit organization that is focused on helping kids thrive in the digital age. So we rate and review media, so that's movies, television, books, apps, and games, for age appropriateness. And we also have a digital citizenship curriculum, which we call kind of like a driver's ed for learning how to use the internet, that we have in about half the schools in all the country. And then we also have a lot of advice and sort of a communications campaign where we advocate for, like I said, digital well-being among kids and families.
So who belongs to Common Sense Media?
So it's we have a website, commonsense.org, and it's totally free. People can come on and get media advice or reviews and ratings. And so it's open to anyone. And then our teachers, we have about 600,000 teachers who sign up to get our curriculum, and our curriculum is delivered free, and it's taught K through 12 in all 50 states in the country.
Who are the people who are doing these ratings, and sort of what is the vetting process for that? I might be inclined to give a great rating for an app I designed.
Yes. No. So we have an editorial team that runs through a rubric that was developed by child psychology experts to rate things for age appropriateness. What we call it, we have this sort of motto where we say sanity, not censorship. We don't tell people yes or no, yes, play this, or no, don't play this. What we say is, you know, we rate it for things that parents might be more concerned about. So, for example, say there's a movie with some curse words in it or some violent content. We'll say that there's violent content or curse words, and then we'll peg an age to that movie. So, for example, you know, the movie Black Panther that's coming out, we'll have a review of the movie, and then we'll give what to watch out for, because a lot of little kids will want to go see it, but they may see something that they're not developmentally ready for. So perhaps we'll rate that movie. I don't think our Black Panther review is up yet, but we might rate it for age 13 and up.
Well, last week you launched something called a Truth About Tech campaign. What's behind that?
So the Common Sense Truth About Tech campaign, we did this in partnership with an organization called the Center for Humane Technology. And basically, the effort is meant to raise awareness among all of us about the impact of technology on our kids specifically, but then on everybody in general. And the point of the campaign is really to understand what the tech company's responsibility is as it relates to creating products, you know, like Facebook and Twitter and Google, that we feel are addictive. And one of the founders of the Center for Humane Technology, his name is Tristan Harris. He is a former Google design ethicist, and he worked at Google for a number of years, and he left Google because he felt like the tech companies weren't disclosing that they were making products that are intentionally addictive, manipulative, and sort of exploiting us. Common Sense partnered with the Center for Humane Technology to really talk about the impact of that technology on our kids' brains.
Well, let's look at this word addictive. What is happening in our brains as we are using these devices? And maybe does it change a little if what's happening in the brain of a 3 or 4 year old compared to a teenager to an adult?
Exactly. So there's a lot of research that still needs to be done in this area. And I would say that presently, the way that we speak about technology and addictive, we're using the word colloquially. We're not diagnosing a physical addiction. But we are saying that there is a behavioral addiction, which is a strong sense of need and craving to be on the site and do things, you know, with the technology that gives us rewards. You know, it's a kind of like I go and I play, or I do my Instagram, or I do my Snapchat, and I get a dopamine hit in the brain. What is beginning to emerge is the same science of any kind of addiction, a dopamine hit in your brain that gives you a sense of pleasure and reward, is happening when we're on these technology platforms. The problem is with kids are particularly vulnerable to this kind of behavior and to this kind of dopamine reward and release. And when you do it too much, it begins to have impact on your brain.
Are tech companies purposefully creating programs and apps that take advantage of the developing minds of kids?
So we can't suggest that tech companies are acting with malicious intent to really hurt our children. That is not what we're trying to suggest at all. But what we are saying is that tech companies create products that, when they go out to investors, they say, our product is sticky, which means that kids come back or people come back all the time to our site, and they will stay on the website for a really long time. Well, translate sticky into, you know, addictive and you know, like an alarm that goes off, exploitative, like they want you back on. It's in their business model. It's inherent in the business model to bring people back and to pull them in. So what we're saying is tech companies are doing this intentionally or unintentionally. It's part of their business model, and we need to build more awareness around that And that ultimately needs to change. The other thing, one more very important thing about this is most of these platforms, think about Facebook, even Instagram, were never designed for children. They weren't consulting child development psychologists about the best technology for kids. They were, kids just sort of were aging down with tech. When the tablet was invented, kids started hopping online all the time. And now, you know, my own kids, starting at age 10, started using some of these platforms.
Well, it's not just the addictive nature of the tech platform. It's also the information that it can relay in the blink of an eye, even without the knowledge of the kid. You have a lot of experience in marketing and communications. In your opinion, is misuse of personal information the rule or the exception?
Well, I would suggest that the platforms themselves reward information that is intentionally sensational or polarizing. Because that is, again, the same that gets your attention. And so if you click on something, if you share something, that is a reward for the tech companies. That's more dollars in their bottom line. And we're rewarding that by clicking on it. The more sensational it is, the more you click. So what we're doing is creating a feedback loop of misinformation. And so we've seen this, you know, we've seen the tech companies acknowledging some of this. They said that, you know, it was really hard to identify bots, which are fake people, machines acting as people, in social media feeds, and now they're doing their best to try to identify them.
There are lots of products out there that might be okay in the hands of an adult and not so much in the hands of kids and teenagers, and I'm thinking like alcohol and cigarettes. And there's a reason that there is an age limit. People can get in trouble for selling below that age limit. You're not allowed to market to those kids. Are there laws? Do there need to be more laws about this when it comes to tech and kids?
So this is an interesting point. And I would suggest actually that, you know, regulation, small R or big R, whatever, is a dirty word, right, in this political climate. But the tech companies are the only companies, if you think about it, that really have never been regulated. They really have gotten a free pass for the past 10 years or so, and they've grown unfettered. You know, you think about it. Cable companies are regulated. Phone companies are regulated. Power companies are regulated. Cars are regulated. So, you know, if you think about what needs to happen, regulation is definitely one option. And the way that I like to think about it, and I was explaining this to my kids, when cars were invented, we didn't have emission standards, we didn't have airbags, we didn't have seat belts, but eventually we began to realize that cars were not necessarily safe for everyone. And there were ways that we could make cars safer. Not suggesting we give up cars altogether because they cause harm to some people, but in fact, let's make them safer for everyone. So seatbelts were invented, airbags, et cetera. So I like to think of it that way. We need a seatbelt for Facebook.
There are privacy issues involving kids. We've been chatting about this. There's also something called the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, and the age 13 is significant in that. Could you develop that for our listeners?
Yeah, I would say that COPPA, is the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, is definitely one avenue, but, you know, it's not enough. I think privacy policies need to be standardized, and they need to be easy for consumers to understand exactly what data is collected and what that data is being used for. And there's just a lot more work that needs to be done on privacy. Common Sense does a lot of work in the privacy area, both on the consumer side and then also within our school's work. So what kind of apps and ed tech products are the kids using, and is that product up to snuff in terms of its privacy? I think we're going to see a lot of movement within the privacy space, too, because of this Truth About Tech campaign.
You have a report that's available online. Again, if you go to commonsensemedia.org, you can find this. It's Inside the Kids' Privacy Zone, which lists privacy principles. And could you develop that idea for us? What are those privacy principles that you'd like us to be thinking about?
Sure. So I don't have it right in front of me, but I will tell you that the general privacy principle is that kids' data should be protected. That's called personally identifiable information. And there should be no data collected for the purpose of selling or monetizing that data. That's number one. Number two is there's no advertising to children. So what's happened is in the digital marketing landscape, we're using data to target and advertise products to children. And we feel that in any environment, whether it's a commercial consumer environment or whether it's in the educational environment, that data is off limits, 100% off limits, even what we call anonymized data. That's number two. Number three, and this is a little bit of a harder sell, is that kids should have the ability to remove information from their online footprint. So we call this the eraser button. But in the case of privacy, you know, oftentimes kids do not have the ability to, well, we say to all of our kids, you know, the internet is written in pen, not in pencil, and you have to be very careful about what you say online. But we feel like kids are really, at some stages, not developmentally prepared, and they'll do something online that will be a mistake that can cost them for a long time thereafter. There's a number of other privacy things that we work on, both at the educational level and the consumer, but kids' privacy is definitely one of our key policy initiatives.
That's a difficult conversation to have with kids, though. Like you said, their brains are not fully developed to even understand the concept of consequences, and especially not long-term consequences.
Yes. Common Sense has a curriculum, like I said before, in schools where we try to map kind of developmentally appropriate lessons to kids at different ages so that as they're going online and as they're starting to use this technology more frequently and in different places for different types of things, that we let the kids understand these really important lessons, such as, you know, how to find trustworthy information online, how to behave online in a social environment where it's an environment of kindness, and how to respond if you see unkindness online. So, you know, kids see a lot of hate speech and a lot of inappropriate content online, and what to do when you encounter that kind of thing. And then all sorts of other kind of what we call digital citizenship lessons. And one of our new things will be about digital well-being, how to understand when you use Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat too much, you know, what the impact is on that, on your social and emotional well-being. And we're looking forward to inserting that, these kinds of modules into our curriculum.
We now have not just Facebook and Google and those kinds of things, those that we can access via a mobile device or whatever. We also have what's called the Internet of Things. We've got digital assistants, and we can say Alexa, what time is it? What's the temperature? Set the alarm, or Google, those kinds of things. Are we being tracked? Is that a privacy issue we should be careful about?
Yes, this is a huge privacy issue, and we are just beginning to understand everything. But think about it. Alexa is listening to us in our kitchen, and the home devices are infiltrating our homes at a rapid clip. I mean, it was half of all American households were planning to buy one in the next year. And, you know, the TV says Alexa during the Super Bowl, and the Alexa wakes up.
Yes.
So, yes, I would suggest this is definitely something that we all need to be very aware of. And little kids especially, they don't quite understand. They don't have the skills to understand that Alexa's not a person. And imagine the potential for those kinds of, you know, Alexa suggested I buy a Barbie doll on Amazon. I mean, it could go any number of directions, so we need to be keenly aware of that.
Well, when we talk about kids, we're naturally protective of their privacy and anything that might disrupt their development. But this interconnectedness that we have here, these kids are known. They're known as kids, and probably their birthday's out there. And now we know when they turn 18. And that does that just delay the predatory marketing behavior?
You know, no. I don't. I think that that's really going to depend on how open your home is, and then also the lessons that you impart on your children about brands. You know, back in the day, before technology was even invented, kids were, they could recognize a brand before they could even read. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think this is really going to change a lot. I mean, I think we're all a little bit desensitized to computer, or to marketing messages. The trick is when it feels like it's coming from a friend, or when it feels like it's coming from somebody that you trust or something that you trust. That's the difference between social media. You know, if on social media we say, oh, so-and-so likes something, you're more inclined to like that too. And that's where this sort of pernicious cycle of influence is falling into play. So those are the kinds of things that we need to be looking out for, and that's different than the way it was previously.
The website, again, is commonsense.org, and there's a lot of information on there, Colby, that is helpful to parents and to educators. This is a good app if you are trying to learn this. This is an app that you might want to stay away from if you're concerned about violence or what have you. But I want to talk about the human side of this here, the role of parents, the role of educators. Let's talk about modeling good tech behavior.
Yes, well, so this is a great example. So Common Sense, we did a great ad campaign this past year. We have what are called public service advertising, and they're issues-based ads. And we partnered with Will Ferrell, the comedian, on what we call device-free dinner campaign. You can see some of them on our website on commonsensemedia.com. And they're all about having a dinner time without your devices. So nobody's looking at their phone, the TV's off, and you're spending time together. And this was just one area that we are focused on, which is how do parents model the right behavior for kids? Whenever we ask kids about growing up in the digital age, without fail, more than half of them say that their parents seem more, quote-unquote, addicted to their phones than even they feel. So we're not doing a good enough job as parents putting our devices away, and what we need to do is focus on ourselves in addition to the lessons that we're sending our kids.
Well, we've got parents modeling good behavior. We've got government regulations perhaps putting up some guidelines. And today, CNN is reporting that Unilever is threatening to pull its advertising from digital platforms that it says have become a swamp of fake news, racism, sexism, and extremism, digital platforms like Google and Facebook. And that includes Dove, Lipton, Ben & Jerry's. Unilever is almost a $10 billion advertising budget. So there's that might be developing as well.
I saw that in the news, and I thought that was a really interesting first step. You know, Unilever is an interesting company. They're so big, and they have such a, like you said, such a big brand advertising budget. And they make very interesting pro-people, pro-planet decisions, and I think this fits right into their company mission to help protect consumers. So I think this is a step in the right direction, and I think we're going to see a lot of other companies come forward and be interested in doing the right thing. I will tell you that when we launched the Truth About Tech campaign last week, we had such an overwhelming response from people saying that they wanted to get involved. They wanted us to come and speak. And the media has just, you know, really loved the campaign and really felt that we were tapping into something super important. So I'm excited about the movement and hoping that the next few months, you know, will definitely raise more awareness on this issue and then ultimately drive change.
Well, we look forward to all of us being protected, not just kids, but adults, too, from this kind of predatory behavior. But to find out more, commonsensemedia.org, and Colby Zentel is the Vice President for External Affairs for Common Sense. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Decoded 8 Book is next.
NPR One is all about
you.
Handpicked public radio content based on what you like.
Who knew?
NPR One connects you to a stream of public radio news, stories, and podcasts curated especially for you.
NPR Hourly Newscasts, Prairie Public Regional News, it's all there.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh.
Download NPR One in the App Store now and select Prairie Public as your station.
For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson.
A world of customized content delivered right to your smartphone.
Okay, guys, headphones on.
The story puts you in the center of the action.
It's on whenever you're on.
NPR One is all about
you.
Download it today.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 13th. On this date in 1929, residents of Ward County mourned the loss of James H. Schofield, a longtime resident and pioneer of the state. He passed away just a few days earlier from a heart condition, following a bout with influenza, marking the end of a prosperous and varied life. Schofield was born in Rochester, Minnesota in 1857. He moved to Dakota Territory as a young man in the early 1880s, living near Candu, and also in Grand Forks and Devil's Lake. He moved to Minot in 1886 when the Great Northern Railroad established the town site where it had halted its western expansion for the winter. Schofield soon entered the local political scene, running for mayor in 1887. Marshall McClure, publisher of the Minot Optic newspaper, acted as his campaign manager. According to later reports, the night before the election, scores of people quickly applied for naturalization so they could cast their vote. The Jamestown Weekly Alert reported, Minot, the year-old and vigorous infant of the Mouse River, had been under the watchful nursing of editor McClure and the other able rustlers long enough to hold a triumphant election for city officers, in which the people's ticket got there, and don't you forget it. The Bismarck Tribune also noted, Minot, the boomtown, held its charter election on Saturday last, and it would have done the heart of the Bismarck old-timer good to have seen the balloters zigzag to the polls with the flourish of whoop and a fringe for enthusiasm. There were two candidates for mayor, one a gambler and a saloon keeper, J.H. Schofield, and the other a hardware dealer named Scott. As will be seen, the town does not go much on hardware. Schofield became the first mayor of Minot. He was afterward involved in multiple political ventures, playing a part in moving the Ward County seat from Burlington to Minot and eventually getting elected as treasurer of the county in 1894. Outside of politics, he found a world of agriculture open to him. He established a livery and sale stable in Minot in 1888 and then got into the sheep business, running a ranch outside of town, as well as a separate farm. Later, he got into the farm implement business. James Schofield was an interesting character in the tapestry of North Dakota's early history and left a legacy of history with his passing. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
When Emily Cross and Dan Dazinski fell in love, they started a band. And then?
We kind of started touring and got married and did a little fairy tale rock and roll thing for a while.
But while making their latest album, they fell out of love and got a divorce. A Valentine's story in reverse on the Next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, Fragrance and Frames is a new program that uses the combination of art therapy and fragrant oils to help participants with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. Advocates say it's produced observable improvement in hand steadiness, handwriting, and anxiety. We'll talk about it with Amy Miller, Director of Memory Care for Touchmark Senior Living in Bismarck. We look forward to having you with us on Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.